Hey guys, how are you doing? Welcome to the show. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. John Kasich is running for president. Didn't he used to be a congressman like 15 years ago or something? Oh, maybe he went home and was a governor back in his home state or something. I think I remember hearing something about that. Meh. Yeah, you know, he might do better than some of the others, even though I don't know how much establishment support and money he's got, but as far as I know, he's not quite as loony as some of the others. Not quite as dumb as some of the others. You know, he's up against Rick Perry and Mike Huckabee, and some of these guys are just complete clowns, so I don't know. Yeah, they're all the same. Later governor, number six says, went home to become governor. All right, well, anyway. So today on the show, man, Jeff Tucker's going to be on to talk about Donald Trump. That'd be fun. And then you know what? Me and Jeff Tucker, we're going to have to do an episode of Eye on the Empire here. We're a few weeks overdue. We were going to do one for the 4th of July, and then you know what? Things just came up and plans fell through, and we didn't do a 4th of July Eye on the Empire. Jeez, so we kind of owe you guys a couple of shows. Well, he'll be on my show today, and then we'll try to do an episode of Eye on the Empire for Liberty.me here coming up. I don't know. How about later this week? Tomorrow, I'm going to be on for 2 hours with Ernie Hancock in the morning before this show. So if you want to hear 4 hours of me tomorrow, tune in early. It'll be 4 hours of me talking. I'll try to get some interviews of other people lined up for the second half of that. All right. Yeah, dude. And then Daniel Larrison's going to be here. Where's my new tab here? I need a new tab here, please. Thank you. Daniel Larrison, he writes at the American Conservative Magazine. God, I'm in my bookmarks toolbar here somewhere. There he is. He writes good stuff for the American Conservative. Good anti-war stuff. TheAmericanConservative.com. And he's been supporting the Iran deal. And not because he's a hippie, but because he's a conservative. That's funny. It's the conservatism in him that makes him anti-war. How nice. Daniel Harrison from the American Conservative Magazine. They're the paleocons. They're the anti-war right. That's who they are. The American Conservative Magazine. You might like them. Especially if you got like a right-wing uncle you want to argue with, you hit him with this stuff. Yeah, Pat Buchanan says, you're a commie, Uncle Frank. How do you like that? You let Democrats tell you what wars to support. Yeah. It can be effective to go at the right from the right. You know? You understand how I mean? Yeah. Okay. So, Larrison on the Iran deal and the future of the Middle East after the Iran deal and et cetera, like that. And Jeff Tucker on Trump, he's got a great new article about Donald Trump. I don't want to tell you too much more about it, but it'll be good. Oh, yeah. Which means, oh, man, see, I almost went off on a tangent and started talking about the Trump thing right there, but I'm going to hold my fire on that. Save it for the Tucker discussion, which means, unfortunately for him, I'm going to talk over his interview. Anyway. Did you miss this? Did you know this? Did you hear the show yesterday? Did you hear other shows? Did you see on the internet that Wesley Clark, the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, former presidential candidate in 2004 for the Democratic Party, has called for throwing Muslims in concentration camps if they're, you know, disloyal? Really? Listen.
A lot of people would say you reap what you sow. So how do we fix self-radicalized lone wolves domestically?
Well, we've got to identify the people who are...
That's an interesting way to set up the question. Maybe we could stop reaping. And then not have to sow. Oh, well.
most likely to be radicalized. We've got to cut this off at the beginning. There are always a certain number of young people who are alienated. They don't get a job, they lost a girlfriend, their family doesn't feel happy here. And we can watch the signs of that, and there are members of the community who will reach out to those people and bring them back in and encourage them to look at their blessings here. But I do think on a national policy level, we need to look at what self-radicalization means, because we are at war with this group of terrorists. They do have an ideology. In World War II, if someone supported Nazi Germany at the expense of the United States, we didn't say that was freedom of speech. We put him in a camp. They were prisoners of war. So if these people are radicalized and they don't support the United States and they're disloyal to the United States as a matter of principle, fine, that's their right. It's our right and our obligation to segregate them from the normal community for the duration of the conflict. And I think we're going to have to increasingly get tough on this, not only in the United States, but our allied nations like Britain and Germany and France are going to have to look at their domestic law procedures.
General Wesley Clark, as always, great to see you, sir. Thanks for your time, and I want to pass along to our viewers.
I love that. That's the best part of that clip, is the MSNBC hairdo going right on with business as usual. Yes, America and all of its Western allies are going to have to reexamine whether we're going to continue to allow the due process of law when we are countries full of young Muslims whose girlfriends have broken up with them, who might be feeling bad, and then could be a lone wolf with sympathy for the Islamic State, wherever they're in what used to be Iraq and Syria before America destroyed them. And so we have the ability to see who these people are. These are who is suspect. Young Muslims who might be feeling bad. I mean, you know how people like that can be. And we'll just put them in camps. It's their right to feel that way. It's our right to put them in camps, he says. Well, here he is, Wesley Clark. Again, the Democrat, Wesley Clark. Which the implication there is supposedly they're a little bit less totalitarian than the right? No? Is that what people believe? Or I just believe that people believe that. Sorry, I didn't mean to assume that you're an idiot or anything. Yeah, I'm just saying that. And then, so here he is on Twitter, furiously backpedaling and forwardpedaling at the same damn time. Hey, I never said Muslim or internment. Or called, I love this, what, did he get Hillary Clinton to write this for him? Or Bill? Or called for new camps. I never called for new camps. Blogosteria. And then he links to the interview, to the clip that I just played you. He never said Muslims, except that was exactly the context, was the discussion was Muslim lone wolves who aren't tied to the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda, but they go ahead and get angry and shoot up a place here or there. We've had some attacks like this at Fort Hood. There was the one, the shopping mall up in Canada where the guy ran down two soldiers. Remember that one? Greenwald pointed that out in his blog. So Clark's excuses, I never said Muslims, it was just I was in the middle of a conversation about Muslims. And I guess, what's his excuse there? No, I think we should lock up black people without trial too. I think we should lock up white people without trial too. No law for anyone. He's being fair. He believes in equality. And he didn't call for new camps. They should just, you know, be interned at Manzanar, like back in the bad old days of FDR. And then he doubles down and says, hey, they're the enemy. You're an enemy combatant if you're a U.S. citizen who chooses them. You're an enemy combatant. You should be separated. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, did you see in the paper where they're saying the Chattanooga shooter was angry because America and Saudi and Qatar and Turkey weren't doing enough to support the rebels in Syria? And they say, you know, he went to Jordan. Oh, inquiring minds want to know whether he was a CIA-trained moderate. I don't know. Maybe not. Just because he is in Jordan doesn't mean he's a CIA-trained moderate, but maybe. Wouldn't that be funny? All of my worst predictions coming true. I don't know. Anyway. Hey, listen, Tommy Franks, the guy that let Osama go, the guy that invaded Iraq for George W. Bush, he told Cigar Aficionado back in, say, 2003 or 4 or 5 or something like that. Probably 4. That if we had another terrorist attack on the scale of 9/11, we would have to revert to a military form of government. Which just goes to show the mindset of these people that they think that the army is most capable of ordering American society. Assuming what? That part of one city's downtown gets knocked down? Come on. I mean, if you had a nuclear war with Russia, I guess, and execute con plan 1209 or whatever the hell, right? Go ahead and get us. But another 9/11 sized attack. Oh, there's no way that freedom could handle a shock like that. Only army control of American society. A military form of government. And it's true that the military is the only institution in America that people trust. I don't know why. They must be crazy. But it's true. And, they figure anything horrible that they do is somebody else's fault, the politician's fault, their fault for loving the politicians who send them to do wrong things. And they're brainwashed from childhood with the capability. They can kill a whole city before you even have breakfast in the morning, you know, all that stuff. They really got their act together. That's what everybody knows about the army, no matter how many wars they lose. So now we have Wesley Clark, his counterpart, the guy that almost got annihilated in a World War III with Russia. Do you know that story? Yeah, in the 1999 Kosovo War, Russian paratroopers seized the Pristina airport that the Americans were supposed to seize, but the Russians got there first. And they had guys on the ground, including this guy who's now some kind of famous singer, although I forget his name. Because what do I know about famous singers? But anyway. He was ordered by Supreme Allied Commander of NATO during the Kosovo War to attack the Russians at the Pristina airport. In fact, I was just reading about this again the other day, and the guy said that he was leading a team of special forces. And they were ready to go, man. Fight the Russians. Let's do this. That's all they knew. They were spoiling for a fight. And he said, man, fight the Russians? I don't think I'm going to follow this order. And he refused the order of General Clark. And then, and this is the funny part of it and the easier name to remember, General Sir Michael Jackson of the British Air Force agreed with the singer, now famous singer guy, commander on the ground and said, belay that order, and told Wesley Clark to his face, I am not going to start World War III for you. Maybe he was a British Army general, I forget. Either way, he ordered the British soldiers under his command to stand down and to refuse Wesley Clark's order, which could very well have gotten us into a war with Russia, which could have very quickly turned into a nuclear holocaust. Thermonuclear holocaust. So, yep, there's your good old Wesley Clark. And he agrees with Tommy Franks that, yeah, you know what? Maybe we'll just have to take you away. If we think that maybe you're disloyal. Well, anyway, that's what they call progressivism. As Jim Ostrowski says, it's the belief that every question has a government policy answer. Everything wrong with anything ever is only a question of what are the Democrats going to do about it for us. That's what the ideology is. That's what I learned was the definition of liberalism in community college from my liberal community college teacher. She actually had a quote from Lyndon Johnson. It's the belief that only the national government is powerful enough to make sure that everyone can live up to the ideals of the Declaration of Independence, life and liberty in pursuit of happiness. Wherever would any of us be without them? Hey, they're actually where capital comes from. I don't know what saving means. What's saving? The interest rate's been zero for 20 years. I don't know what it means to save. I think all capital comes from government. It's the only reason anyone has anything. And so Wesley Clark is just the argument ad absurdum, denying that he called for people to be put in concentration camps and then saying, all I'm saying is they should be put in concentration camps. I never said Muslims. I meant everybody. I never said internment. I meant concentration. And I never called for new camps. They should be put at camps that we already have. We're at war with ISIS. I'm frustrated with the argument that sedition is free speech. I mean, come on. Jefferson repealed the Alien and Sedition Clauses in 1801, dude. Nuts to you, John Adams. You suck at being president. Although, thanks for keeping us out of war with France. Great is the guilt of an unnecessary war. That's even on a bumper sticker. That's how you know it's a real quote. LibertyStickers.com. All of great John Adams anti-war quotes. We're at war with ISIS. I'm frustrated. Not that America declared war with ISIS. Not that ISIS ever attacked the United States. Not that ISIS isn't all the faults of George W. Bush and Barack H. Obama. Frustrated with arguments, sedition is free speech. Homegrown ISIS cells are a threat. But we haven't had a single ISIS cell yet. The only ISIS busts have been FBI sting operations. ISIS is the enemy. U.S. citizens who choose ISIS are spies. Huh? So if you like ISIS on Facebook, you're a spy for them. You are spies, enemy combatants, or both, if you choose them. Whatever that means. Could mean anything. Government should separate those people from the rest of us. I never said that. Let me say it again. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. and they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson, 1-800-874-9760, or stop by rrbi.co.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest is Jeff Tucker. He, of course, is the, the chief liberty officer. That's what it's called. Over at liberty.me, which is the great libertarian social network that you should join and friend me on, and him too. Hey, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Good. I'm talking to you from the offices of the Foundation for Economic Education, where I'm also the web builder and that sort of thing.
Great. And that's fee.org, of course. 10 million pages of great economic writing there. lots and lots of good stuff to read. All right. So listen, you're also the co-host with me of Eye on the Empire, which we haven't done in a few weeks, but it's time to do another one. So we should do another one. What do you think?
Yeah, long past time. We got to get on this thing. You know, maybe in the next couple of days we should jump on this.
Yeah, I'm down with it.
I miss it. When,
Thursday or Friday is good for me.
Yeah, I'm good with either one of those things. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, email back and forth later.
Okay.
Hey, listen, you wrote an article, and it was really interesting, and hey, I'm glad I got you here to talk about it. Trumpism. What?
Yeah, well, Scott, here's the thing about that article. As I was thinking back, I've been writing for a long time, written thousands of articles, you know. I think that somehow this article has been more widely circulated than perhaps anything I've ever written.
Oh, really?
The first draft, you know, I wrote it like almost immediately after I saw that Trump speech at Freedom Fest in Vegas. And it went on liberty.me. I did a version of it for free. Then it was picked up by Newsweek, and that's when it went viral. I was inundated with interview requests and my Twitter account.
So Newsweek ran the whole piece?
Yeah, Newsweek ran the whole piece.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, it was kind of an epic thing for me.
They're really afraid of him, aren't they? That they would run Jeff Tucker in Newsweek. That's really something. Hey, that's not a knock against you. That's praise for you. You're way too good for them to ever consider running your thoughts in their paper, but they're just, anything, you know, I saw Karl Rove up there spitting and sputtering as though Trump is not just the ultimate, you know, kind of summation of Rovian Republicanism in this country. I mean, he owns 21st century conservatism as his project, and this is what it's wrought. And to see him and all the National Review and Lindsey Graham and everybody just spitting and sputtering and denouncing him, It's a riot. I got to admit. I just love it because I think regular people, not the ones who go for it and, you know, who really like him, but everybody else, I think that they can tell that the rest of these Republicans are exactly like him. He just is rude. You know what I mean? He just says what they all want to say. But when it comes down to who to tax and who to kill and all that kind of stuff, they're pretty much in line. Who to hate.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I think you make a good point. I mean, it's pretty much in line. I wouldn't say exactly the same because, I mean, Trump kind of ramps it up in a strange way. He's like a cartoon version of their worst sort of darkest dreams.
Right. And, yeah.
You know,
he's their argument ad absurdum.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's why I thought it was important to focus on him. I mean, actually, listening to his speech was very weird. You know, it went on for an hour, and my jaw was on the floor the entire time. And you know, most of the, you're right, the rest of these Republican people have sort of cleaned up their act. You know, they're sort of trying to appeal to the media. They're trying to get through this election thing. You know, by staying safe and that sort of thing. Trump doesn't care, right? So you're right. He just expresses what they sort of believe in their darkest
thoughts.
He's
their id, is what he is, right? he's got no super ego to tell his id to cool it.
You know, that's a really, you have a really good, you should have written this article, Scott. Yeah, but what was interesting to me is that people are so routinely shocked by the combination of policies that guys like this push. And they don't, you know, they just think, oh, wow, he favors massive protectionism. He wants to keep dollars home and keep shipping goods out. Oh, isn't that interesting? He really hates immigrants. Wasn't it fascinating that he seems to be appealing to, the religious right, you know, by claiming to be a Presbyterian or something, you know, and they think all this stuff is sort of haphazard in a way. Oh, he wants to run the country like a business. You know, that's his number one theme. He wants to be basically the CEO of the country. And they think all these things are kind of randomized and haphazard. But as I listened to it, what overwhelmed me was just how perfectly he has revived a very old tradition in 20th century political thought that's been otherwise, you know, completely neglected by modern political culture, namely the fascistic model of social organization as an alternative to socialism, you know? And so that was the purpose of my article, was basically to explain what fascism is. Why it's not just an insult. It's not just like calling somebody, you know, an idiot or a bad guy or something like that. This is a legitimate political philosophy. It's a wholly, sort of robust, and comprehensive view of the relationship between the state and the citizen. And he just sort of perfectly encapsulates this in every way. And you're right. I mean, the other Republicans also do, but in a way that's much more sort of palatable and compatible with existing civic conventions. Mm-hmm. Trump just doesn't care anything about any of that stuff, which is actually part of his appeal and which is also part of the fascist tradition. You know, these guys, these sort of interwar dictators, this generation of interwar dictators, you know, sort of rose up after the collapse of the economy in 1929. They all railed against the establishment too, you know, and wanted the population to rally around them as personal geniuses who were courageous and were willing to stand up to, you know, the existing establishment. And that's very appealing to people because, I mean, the current system doesn't work and everybody knows it, right? Mm-hmm. So people are looking for an alternative. And these guys are there to push an alternative. And it's all based on a kind of flamboyant rejection of rationality.
Yeah.
And you can see it among Trump's followers. I mean, there's an element of wild fanaticism with them that's like completely out of control. I mean, my article generated more hate mail than I've ever received, you know, from Trump supporters. And not that they took issue with any one thing that I said, but rather they suspect that I don't trust as they trust, you know. You know, it's like that.
What is it with you?
I know. So it's very strange. There's a kind of, I always have believed this, that there's an element of religious attachment to the idea of, you know, let's let the state run the social order, because it's such a bad idea and it's failed so much that you almost have to sort of suspend all belief in rationality in order to sort of embrace it. But you take it a step further when you get a guy in front of you who says, look, I've got the business experience. I've got the talent. I'm smart. The rest of these people are stupid. Trust me, I can run it. And something goes wrong in some people's brains. You know, they're like, heck yeah, let's do this thing, right? You know, we need a new era of greatness and centralization. And I mean, this is a guy, look, Scott, in your whole life, in your whole political life, do you remember a single aspirant to national office standing in front of a crowd saying, we're going to make nuclear weapons mean something again, and then have the crowd cheer?
Yeah, no, is that what he said?
Yeah.
Like, we're going to use them for more meaningful threats, at least.
Something like that. Ahead. I mean, I've never heard a politician say anything like that. I mean, nuclear weapons, you know, we have the largest nuclear arsenal in the world, right?
Yeah.
But politicians don't talk about it much. I mean, he's up there in front of crowds bragging about it, saying we're going to take pride in our ability to wipe out humanity.
Man. All right. Hold it right there. We got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Jeff Tucker right after this. Check him out at liberty.me. Trumpism, the ideology. Fascism, you know. Familiar. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey guys, welcome back. All right, so we are talking with Jeffrey Tucker from Liberty.me and from Fee about his article, Trumpism, the Ideology. And I like the way you say, well, there's so much to go back over here, Jeff. I like the way you say that he doesn't know that he's parroting, you know, Philip Drew and Benito Mussolini and Franklin Roosevelt and other fascists here. He's basically just being himself up there ranting and raving, and yet he fits right in there. And it's important, I think, what you say, too, about how, even though really the rest of these Republicans mostly agree on these policies, he's not a conservative. What he is a radical. He's just as far to the right as them, but he is, you know, again, unencumbered by anything that, you know, any counter incentive to act the way he acts, you know, the way the rest of them have, you know, all these little things to think about. He's got a deep enough wallet to finance his own campaign that he's not really checked by all the different things that they have to think about. So he can be as radical as they want to be, basically. Yeah. And then, to really imagine him in power, I mean, think about him actually being the president. Can anyone think, you know, pretend for a minute that the Constitution would bind him in any way? I mean, American policy would just be his whim on a daily basis. I mean, listen to the way he talks. He'll say the exact same thing twice and then but add a word the second time that completely contradicts the first thing he said. And then
it's all about trusting him.
All over the freaking place.
He said, too, I mean, just a few days ago, he said something, I heard him say something like, when he's president and he wants that Ford plant to move from China back to the U.S., he said, believe me, they're going to do it. So, you know, imagine a president who thinks that he can just order around U.S. companies and where they're going to locate their business. I mean, that's an astonishing, that's a totalitarian level of power, you know, completely unchecked. I mean, this is, you know, completely delusional. But I'm telling you, there's a segment of the voters who go for this crap. And you can see it right now, in the polls that are coming out. He is not shrinking. He is rising. His lead in the Republican, field here is spreading wider and wider and wider. He's now got 24% support. And and second is Scott Walter with only 13% and Jeb Bush with 12. And then it gets lower. After that, and Rand Paul slipped completely 5 percentage points. So what's interesting is that the more the Republican establishment attacks this guy, the more people like him. And even his criticism of John McCain, you know, that was an interesting case because he stood up and said, this guy's no war hero. He set out the war, you know. And, an outrageous comment at some level. On the other hand, what the GOP establishment doesn't understand is that everybody is sick and tired of stupid McCain. All right. Yeah, so, yeah. You know, for one guy to finally come out and say, you know, to call this guy's bluff and say, I don't really give a crap about his so-called heroism. Doesn't sound like heroism. That was a delight to many people. And there was a brilliant article in the New York Times a couple of days ago about his speaking in Iowa where, you know, some Republican blowhard got up and denounced Trump for dissing McCain. And there was only light clapping, you know, just kind of, whatever. But when Trump spoke himself and he would say these outrageous things about he was going to, you know, I mean, basically fascistic plans about, you know, he knows exactly how production should happen, you know, where plants should be located, what immigrants should come in, what immigrants should be shipped out, and so on and so on. You know, basically, you know, he's running for totalitarian powers. You know, everybody's cheering and loving him. He only got in trouble in Iowa when, Scott, this is actually true, when he said the words damn and hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read that.
And then you heard all the mutterings and murmurings among the crowd, and the New York Times reporter just hilariously found somebody to say something like, yeah, I'm a little worried about him because he may not be born again.
Yeah. Otherwise, so, he's great, though. Yeah.
So, yeah. So Trump could actually, you know, intensify his
bogus. This is why I love all this, though. I mean, I absolutely love this because really he is no more legitimate for that office, and he's blatantly not legitimate for that office, but he's really not any too much different in kind than the rest of the Republicans in a way. He doesn't deserve to have power any less than Jeb Bush deserves it or anything like that. So he's making a mockery of the entire process that deserves to be mocked. I guess there's a risk that he could actually win. Or something like that. That could be a real problem.
I don't like that.
But I also like that he's calling out the Republican rank and file, the conservatives of America, and saying, aren't we all a bunch of Nazis? And they're all saying, yes, we are. You know, I guess it's too politically incorrect to just outright hate black people right now. But how about Mexicans? Yeah, we can all pick on the Mexicans and the queers. Let's get them. And, you know. That's he's a great leader for them, and he proves to everyone else who they are and what they are. Oh, yeah, you people really love freedom, huh, you Tea Partiers? Yeah, you love freedom from your liberal black president, but, yeah, just wait until the next conservative's in power. And it'll be like, you know, Jeb Bush, George W. Bush years will look like libertarian years.
You know, I think, you know, there's something, and I've always believed this, there's something at the very heart of American right-wing post-war right-wing ideology, you know, what we now call sort of Tea Party conservatism, because there's so much good about it, but there's a weird sort of underneath aspect to it that's nationalistic, nativistic, and essentially totalitarian. But it takes the right sort of political leader to kind of extract that. And it's been fascinating to me to see how Trump has sort of weirdly managed to do that in his bungling, idiotic way. He's nonetheless sort of unleashed this inner totalitarian core. And to me, the sad thing about American political culture is we don't have a word for people like this. You know, people just go, oh, well, this is just the yammerings of a lunatic. No, this is a revival of a very robust and fairly coherent political ideology that was extremely popular in the interwar period and actually much more successful than socialism ever was. Fascism had a much better run of it around the world than socialism ever did. And that's the tradition he represents. And I'm just sorry that we can't just use that term. But this is why I wrote the article. I think he makes a very interesting study. You know, we need to kind of confront this dark heart of American and really Western democratic ideology that's not socialistic as such. It's something different. It's still totalitarian. But it rejects the sort of cultural biases of the left. You know, it's made its peace with private property, with the family, with the presence of religion in society. But it wants all this sort of bourgeois firmament, you know, sort of redirected and channeled into a grand national purpose that always ends up in war. I mean, that in the end, you know, Trump is probably the most ghastly warmonger who's ever run for political office in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. At least most overt warmonger. I mean, that's what it's all about. To him, the whole world is the U.S.'s enemy, always and everywhere.
Yeah, well, and when it comes to the Islamic State, he keeps saying, well, I'm going to send a patent in there to just wipe them out and steal all their oil. That's what we should have done, is just starved them all to death by taking all their oil away. Whoa, man. Okay.
Yeah,
again, a lot of Republicans agree with that, but Republicans with power don't talk that way, you know? But there are, you know, again, back to the rank and file American conservatives who love that stuff. That's right. Kill all Arabs until they're all dead, and then we won't have to worry about them anymore. Now, that's conservatism. That's American, you know, nationalism right there.
Ship out all the Mexicans, bring all plants, U.S.-owned plants abroad, bring them home to provide jobs. So there's a very interesting aspect to this sort of fascistic ideology, too, that it's generally pro-labor union in a way, or at least this pro-labor agenda. It just wants it to sort of serve the state. So that's a little bit unusual.
Kind of part of fascism too, right? Because it's all about the supply side ruling the state and vice versa, kind of, you know, working together against the demand side, which is how freedom works. I mean, if you read Philip Drew, Edward Mandel House's fantasy about a fascist America, there's a national government bureaucrat and a labor union leader on every board of directors, you know?
Yeah, it's really true. The other interesting thing about it is that he doesn't really address anything like what he wants to do about current government functioning. Like, he doesn't talk about education policy. He doesn't really talk about, housing policy. He doesn't talk about the federal budget. I mean, none of these sort of details of policy, matter to him, you know, and, he refuses to even address these questions, you know, he just says, you know, you just give me power and I will do the right thing. Just trust me with it. And a lot of people are willing to go along with that. You know, I mean, this is just, I mean, ultimately in the end, Scott, we face a choice between freedom and control, you know, and, I like Trump to this extent. I mean, he's giving us a chance to really sort of discuss this issue, you know, which way do we want to go forward to a world of private property, individual liberty, you know, decentralized decision making and, distributed networks and technology and that sort of thing? Or do we really want to return to an authoritarian centralized, total state? And he's forcing people to confront this issue.
Yeah.
And it's good for the GOP, essentially. Okay. Let's talk about whether or not he actually stands a chance. I mean, you raised that question and I think it's a really interesting question. Politics has surprised me enough in my lifetime that I don't think that I'm prepared to say, oh, this is a temporary blip, you know, it's just going to go away. I would like that to be true in a way, although I'm not happy with any of the alternatives either, you know. But I don't know. What's your feeling about that? I mean, is the Republican establishment so tightly in control of our electoral system and the nomination process that there's no chance that he could ever win it? I mean,
you got to give them higher numbers than Ron or something like that, just because, one, there are a lot more Jacksonian fascists in America than there are libertarians. And two, he's got billions of dollars of liquid cash, at least, you know, a couple that he can spend on this. And, you know, Hillary is going to have the biggest campaign ever at $1 billion, and he can top that. So.
And part of his appeal. And
I don't think you can threaten him, right? I don't think he feels like he has anything to lose. He's not afraid of anything.
And people love that. People love that. You know, the biggest applause line that he had in Vegas was when he said, you know what? The whole political system is a racket. Everybody who's giving these campaign contributions to all these people, all they're asking for is a quid pro quo. The minute they get in office, the phone's going to be ringing off the hook. Now do my bidding. He said there's graft and corruption behind every dollar that's contributed to every candidate in this country. And people cheered because that's an actual truth.
Of course, yeah.
And it's awesome to consider the implications of that.
Right.
And then he went on to say, look, I've got all the money I need. I don't need anybody's money. I don't owe anybody anything. And boy, you could just feel it in the room. People were like, yeah.
That's the story of Philip Drew too, right there, where look at how corrupt the political system is. The senators and the bankers all in on it together to bail each other out and protect themselves and all this corporate corruption. All we need is a man on a white horse to come in and clean house. Somebody who doesn't owe anybody anything because he has the loyal appreciation of his countrymen behind him.
Yeah, that's the whole fascistic appeal. And I tell you what, it sold really well at the crowd I was in. And, you know, I heard him in Vegas earlier that day. There were 5,000 people gathered in Phoenix, Arizona, to rally behind his anti-immigrant message. I mean, this guy is really kicking up a storm out there. You know, it's just it's awesome. And the more the GOP establishment attacks him, the more he seems to be growing. You know, maybe this is all a temporary blip, but I don't know. I mean, it's pretty awesome to watch it all happening.
Well, yeah, I mean, his competition is pretty damn mediocre too. So we'll see how they do, I guess. I don't know. And, you know, there's an important lesson here also, as you point out in the article, about how just because someone's a successful businessman doesn't make them a libertarian, doesn't prove that they even understand economics at all. And I guess his multiple corporate bankruptcies might tend to go along with showing that. The guy's always building the skyscraper right when the bubble's about to pop and this kind of thing. And it also goes to show about how libertarians don't necessarily like businessmen at all. We just like the market. That's different. And
yeah.
I think liberals really get that wrong. Like, our job is simply to cover for corporate power or something like that. They don't really get that. It's about individual freedom. That's what it's about.
Yeah, and big business also hates competition. That's what people don't understand. I mean, you know, competition is fine when you're the underdog. You know, it gives you a chance to get out there and make your mark. But once you're at the level of Trump, competition is your enemy. That's the thing that they consider inefficient. It's terrible. It's wasted resources. It's knocking down the good guys and putting the bad guys in charge, you know. So, you know, in fascist ideology, the enemy is exactly market competition. And that's what he's targeted. That's what he thinks is the great problem in America and the world, is there's just too much market competition. We need an iron hand at the top to decide who the winners are and keep them in place. And it's got to be smart people with lots of resources and unlimited power. And then we can make the world a better place.
Oh, man. So. All right. Thanks very much for coming back on the show. I sure appreciate it, Jeff.
It's good to talk to you, Scott. Let's talk soon.
Okay. Definitely will do. All right, y'all. That's a great Jeff Tucker. He's at the Foundation for Economic Education and Liberty.me. And we'll be right back with Daniel Larrison in just a sec. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. All right, you guys, welcome back. Sorry, went over time into the break there with Jeff Tucker. You can hear the entire interview later on at scotthorton.org/interviews. Our next guest on the show today is Daniel Larrison from the American Conservative magazine. He's been writing a lot about the Iran deal and Yemen, too. Welcome back. How are you doing?
Just fine, Scott. Thanks for having me back.
Very happy to have you here. And, you know, I forget if I said this out loud or I only thought it later or what, but when Tom Woods was interviewing me about the Iran nuclear deal the other day, I definitely at least meant to say, you know what, just ask Daniel Larrison. He'll tell you. He's from the American Conservative magazine. He can make the case better than me. You seem to be pretty convinced that this Iran deal is better than the status quo or the next most possible future. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it does a number of things that are beneficial both for us and for the Iranians and for the wider region. I think the most important thing from our side is that it finally addresses the nuclear issue in a way that's satisfactory to Washington and to the other major powers, which I believe greatly reduces the chance that there's going to be any sort of so-called preventive attack on Iran over the nuclear issue. And I think it makes that prospect much less likely, that's a huge win for us, in that it keeps us from getting drawn into yet another conflict in the region when we're already involved in far too many. And certainly that's also a win for all of the countries in the region that won't be sucked into the conflict along with us. and obviously on the Iranian side, not getting attacked, not being starved and sanctioned in the way that they have been over the last several years is to their advantage as well. The other thing that I think it does, it definitely advances the cause of nonproliferation. It does put meaningful limits and monitoring on the Iranian nuclear program so that in the event that there were a desire on their part to try to build a nuclear weapon, that would become evident and there would be ways to discourage them from proceeding along that line. And it's also very much to the advantage of Iranian civil society, because they're finally going to be allowed to breathe again, and these sanctions that have been crippling them are going to be lifted, which will in turn make it much harder for the regime to keep squeezing them as much as it has.
All right. So, first of all, let's start with that point right there. That is an important point. It's one that's been made at least from time to time over the years that, you know, and hey, Iran's far away, so it's kind of hard for Americans to see these things going on. But they've got their right-wing hawks that hate the great Satan and don't want to deal with us, and that like to use the excuse that anybody who opposes them must be working for the Americans. We saw a lot of that in 2009. The whole Green Movement was discredited as a CIA plot when I don't think much of it was anyway. I mean, certainly the American government supported it. I don't think they invented it. But and it's something that student activists and so forth have had to put up with over the years there. And as, I guess Scott Ritter said, you know, a decade ago, yeah, the moderates are the enemy. The Iranian moderates are the enemies of the American hawks. They want to silence those voices and make it look like only the hawks have sway in Tehran. And so what you're saying is the opposite of that. Now that we had this deal, that this is really good for the moderates. It makes them right about something very important in Iranian politics.
Yes, well, it should yield very tangible benefits for Iranians generally and specifically for the Iranian middle class that has been squeezed very badly over the last few years. And really, they are going to be the foundation of any significant movement for social and political reform inside the country. And anything that works to their advantage is going to undermine the position of Iran's hardliners, which I think we could only be glad to see. I mean, obviously, our hardliners aren't glad to see that because they sort of feed off of the antagonism between Iran and the U.S. And regional clients. So by undermining the grip that hardliners have on within their own country, that could eventually help to reduce tensions between Iran and the surrounding countries as well.
All right. Now that's a real important point, too, because, of course, really with all American foreign policies, there's the truth, and then there are a lot of competing narratives against that. And the biggest competing narrative here, other than just the nuclear program itself, which we'll get back to, but is that by normalizing relations with Iran, really, we're appeasing their hegemony. We're allowing them. We're giving away the entire store, not just letting them keep their nuclear program, but sanctifying Iranian expansion and domination of the region. And so even though their nuclear program is being scaled back from, 20 miles an hour to 5, or however you want to characterize it, that kind of thing, and the Saudis and the rest of the GCC have that much less to worry about when it comes to that, they still are pushing this entire narrative, and maybe it's true, that America is moving more toward, as Pat Buchanan says in his article that's running today, in fact, opening up our options for, and in fact, I think Scott McConnell talks about this as well in your magazine, opening up the options for allying with the Iranians and working with the Iranians in a more open way on issues like fighting Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State and other things in the region that were always completely off the table because of the nuclear program. So maybe the critics are right that actually, we're backstabbing all of our great allies in favor of these Iranian mad mullahs.
Well, and I don't know that I would go that far. But what I think we are going to see is that there will be some greater acknowledgement of where Iran and the U.S. have common security interests in the region. But we're clearly seeing almost a desperate attempt by the administration to keep placating the Gulf states and Israel by sending loads more weapons to them. In one report this week, I think I saw that they were proposing that the annual aid to Israel be increased from the $3.1 billion that it is to a higher figure. So there's a desire to try to buy off these clients and to prove that, in fact, there is no realignment going on. There is no major change in our regional policy. And I mean, unfortunately, I think that's the case, that there won't be a major change. I think the good news is that, at least as far as the conflict with Iran goes, that has become much less likely. Whether we continue to back our clients in their obsessions with battering Yemen, for instance, in their fear of Iran, is another question. It seems like we're happy to do that, or the government is happy to do that.
So, in other words, we can still keep up our Cold War against them in a lot of ways and don't necessarily have to change just because we've got this biggest issue out of the way. What it does mean is now war is off the table, finally, as long as we have this deal.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. And funny to think, because I saw even Bill Kristol was retweeting and adding his own comment to something that Aaron David Miller said, that they gave up something they didn't have in order to get all this money. Of course, it's their money, but never mind that. Point is, here's Bill Kristol even making the argument that, man, they weren't even making nuclear weapons, and now we're lifting all the sanctions just for them to continue not making nuclear weapons. Seems kind of silly, but hey, that was the position that they put us in, right? The Bill Kristol and his merry men.
Sure. Well, and of course, the point or the response to that would be that the sanctions were put in place in order to the extent that they were of any value, they were put in place to dissuade Iran from pursuing a nuclear weapon. And so once Iran has committed once again not to doing that, of course, they'd already committed to not do that under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But by accepting these even more stringent standards that go above and beyond what the NPT requires, Iran is demonstrating that they don't intend to pursue that sort of weapon.
All right, hold it right there. It's Daniel Larrison. I'm sorry, I got to go. Daniel Larrison from the American Conservative Magazine. We'll be right back in just a sec, y'all. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Daniel Larrison. He teaches peace in the pages of the American Conservative magazine and at his great blog there at theamericanconservative.com/author/Larrison. We're talking about the Iran deal and conflict. And I'm sorry we were interrupted by the heartbreak. Daniel, you were finishing up a thought there about how the threat of war has really been pushed aside, if the threat of the Cold War has not here.
Right, and I think that's one of the great gains for our side out of this. And I think the great news for the U.S. is that this was achieved simply by accepting a compromise, admittedly a compromise we could have had a decade ago, but a compromise that acknowledges that their nuclear program is going to remain in place in some form, but that as long as it's kept under reasonable limits, there's no reason why we can't live with that. And arguably there's a reason why we couldn't live with them with a much more advanced nuclear program either, but that's another debate. Well, what we have right now is a very successful compromise that actually costs the U.S. nothing, and that this is the point I think needs to be emphasized even more in talking about it and in trying to persuade people of the merits of this deal. The U.S. gives up nothing except the punitive measures that it has been imposing on Iran. In other words, we lose nothing and we gain the benefits of this compromise, which include making a new war less likely. And so all of the costs and risks that would go along with that new war are also fading away or becoming much less likely to happen. And that it seems like that's a great success for our foreign policy for a change, and one that makes the avoidance of war more certain.
All right, now, then again, we've been fighting for Iran in Iraq for the last, 14, 13, 12 years here, whatever. And I know it's a funny quirk of history that George Bush refused to talk to them the whole time he was fighting a war for them and for the most Iranian-backed parties, the Dawa and Supreme Islamic Council and the Badr Brigades there through the whole Iraq war. And it looks like, hey, at least de facto right now, we have a joint operation between the Iranian Special Forces, the American Air Force and Navy, and Shiite militias on the ground, led by the Badr Corps, attacking Fallujah. And that's the shape of the war against the Islamic State, at least in the former Iraq. It's a much more divided and quote-unquote confused policy in Syria anyway. But so do you worry that maybe this is going to lead to a full-scale kind of alliance with them again in Iraq? Because, well, I'll just say one more thing about it. It seems like if that's who rousts the Islamic State out of Fallujah and Mosul and Ramadi, if that's even possible, then you have a real problem with hardcore Shiite Iran-backed sectarians occupying those cities or, you know, being in charge of their, quote, reconstruction where they choose the new Sunni leaders of them or however that's supposed to work. That just seems like a whole new mess of details, more blowback to come.
Well, I certainly think I've been saying for some time that our involvement in the war on ISIS doesn't make sense for us, that it's not necessary for us. And it does put us in these very ugly compromises with sectarian militias, with the sectarian government in Baghdad. And that was true from the beginning when we first got involved, when Maliki was still in charge. That's something that would need to be address as a way to fix our policies in Iraq and Syria. I suppose by concluding the deal, we may actually have a little bit more freedom to back away from that sort of collusion with Iran-backed forces. But it's not clear at all that there's any desire to make use of that freedom to extricate ourselves from this conflict. So I think that's an ongoing problem, but that's got to do with our preoccupation with fighting ISIS, quite apart from anything else that's going on in the region.
Mm-hmm. I see what you mean. I see what you mean. You're saying that if we're getting along better with the Iranians now, then it's less of a worrisome talking point that, oh, no, the Iranians are the ones fighting the Islamic State instead of us. So that makes it easier to go ahead and just let them. And let it be them instead of us, because who cares?
Right. Well, and an acknowledgement that they're the regional power that has the incentive to fight them, and obviously our regional clients and allies, in the case of the Saudis and the Turks, clearly are not making that a priority and are in fact working on the other side to some extent. So there's, I would see that as certainly a better arrangement in letting the Iranians take responsibility for it, and I wouldn't be concerned, as many hawks are, about being accused of so-called losing Iraq to them, is that that was already done a decade ago.
Yeah. All right, so now, what about GOP politics? Because you've written quite a bit about this, the different Republican candidates and their stands on this deal, but then I think it's one of your most recent blog entries here is Yeah, second to last is about the poll results that show that even Republicans pretty much support this deal, especially you tell them the alternative is invasion. If that's the only way to make sure that there's no nuclear program at all there, which is supposedly the only definition of a good deal, even according to Rand Paul. As Tom Woods was pointing out to me on his show the other day, that, you know, by the time of the election, this thing will have been going on. The deal will have been in effect for more than a year at that point. And if the Iranians are abiding by it and everything is really cool, they're going to be, and this is a deal the American people in general already supported anyway, then they're all taking their stand. They have their consensus among Republicans, and they think it stands for the consensus of the American voters, but or even the Republican voters, but it's really not looking like it. So what do you think is going to happen with that?
I think it is going to be a liability for whoever ends up getting the Republican nomination, because they have taken such a reflexive and uncompromising position, and not just against adopting the deal, but going farther and saying that they will repudiate it as soon as they have the opportunity. And that's clearly not what the public endorses. The one survey from the Washington Post this week showed that over 40% of Republicans are in favor of the deal. So there's a large constituency inside the party that's not being heard at all and is not being represented in the presidential field, but which is fairly extraordinary. Would you think that this would be, because it is one of the most important foreign policy issues, that there would be at least some dissent somewhere? But unfortunately, that seems to be the one issue on which there's pretty much total uniformity.
Well, it would be fun kind of to see the GOP completely impale themselves again on their foreign policy and then wonder, why do people like the Democrats when that's not it? That surely is not it. It's just right. That they're worse. That's all. They prove it over and over again. If that's even possible, they prove it. All right. Thanks, Daniel. You're the best, man.
Thanks, Scott.
That's Daniel Larrison. He's at theamericanconservative.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Check this out. I thought this was funny. A bunch of, I don't know if they're Nazis or they're just pro-Confederate flag people or what, but they're going to their march. And so this guy, oh, no, it says KKK marchers. So, yeah, it's the Klan walking to their rally, and this guy has a sousaphone. He starts following them down the street.
And this is what stupid looks like.
All right. I just think funny things are funny. It's not my fault. Anyway. Stupid Klansman. Get the hell out of here. So this is funny. Moon of Alabama. I like that blog. It's a good blog, man. They write stuff there that I like reading. Moon of Alabama. Hiding its own role, New York Times publishes anonymous official Snowden smears. You know, I saw Glenn Greenwald all pissed off about this on Twitter, too. And he's often pissed off, so I wasn't sure if, you know, there's a reason to be or not. But, oh, then I saw what it was. And, yeah, you know what he's pissed off about? Numerous reporters. The one I saw this morning, he was attacking Kurt Anderson of the Associated Press. Numerous reporters going, oh my God, everybody, look, I hope Edward Snowden is happy. I hope Glenn Greenwald is happy that now the bad guy terrorists have gone through the Snowden documents and now they're encrypting their communications. Really, huh? According to an anonymous official's claim to the Times. That's it. No evidence. No evidence. And then, of course, in today's fairy tale, as Moon of Alabama puts it, we're told that the Islamic State leader takes steps to ensure his group's survival. Hmm. Wow, that is pretty incriminating. And then they get to the Snowden part. It's just an assertion. That's it. There's nothing more to it. The Islamic State has also studied revelations from Edward J. Snowden, the former National Security Agency contractor, about how the United States gathers information on militants. A main result is that the group's top leaders now use couriers or encrypted channels that Western analysts cannot crack to communicate, intelligence and military officials said. Oh, it's all Snowden's fault, say anonymous government officials, and the NYT stenographer writes it down and publishes it. But Osama bin Laden was killed before Snowden left the NSA. Did he use cell phones, or did he fear that those would be used to trace him? Have Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State started to use encryption only after the Snowden revelations? No. And then they go on to prove that, of course they know that the NSA is hunting their asses, and they have been this entire time. He cites a quote only from 2011, but he could have cited one from 2001, for crying out loud. Give me a break. That, yeah, they encrypt when they can, and they use couriers on motorcycles or on foot or whatever when they can in order to not get electronically intercepted. Anyway, everybody knows about this. And then, by the way, writes Moon of Alabama, B. Bernard, I guess is his name, at Moon of Alabama, by the way, what secret did Snowden actually publish? He gave NSA papers to reporters and newspapers, and they are the ones who selected some and made them public. One of those papers was the New York Times, and he provides three links. The sentence inculpating Snowden should thereby have said, quote, the Islamic State has also studied revelations published by the New York Times about how the United States gathers information on militants. That the New York Times was involved in the same issue that is now used by anonymous officials to smear Snowden is, of course, not mentioned in the story at all. Disgusting. And by the way, I saw a thing. It wasn't just the John Oliver thing. It was something else. Oh, no, it was a friend of mine sent me an email about how he talks to people who have never heard of Snowden. They never heard of him. What do you mean you never heard of him? He was the guy that leaked a gigantic pile of apparently hundreds of thousands of National Security Agency documents to the reporters at The Intercept and The Washington Post. That revealed how they're reading your email, how they're saving your cell phone's location data forever. Oh, for only 5 years, trust them. How they have your ass. You don't even know the name. It doesn't even sound familiar. I don't know. And you know what? There was a time, I guess it's been since I was a teenager, but a young one. But still, there's a time where I didn't really care about politics and current events and whatever the hell. I understand people got other priorities, but I mean, you at least heard of the NSA thing and you're against it, right? I mean, kinda in the vaguest way. No, didn't you hear there was this one of them computer genius kids? He ran off with all the files, gave them not to Russian China, gave them to American journalists. Didn't you know? I'll tell you what. If you want to geek out, type into your search engine. They'll be keeping track of this for the rest of your life. But still, type into your search engine EFFNSA. And what you'll find there is a page called Primary Sources. And what you'll find there is all the documents that have been released and all of the original news stories that came out at the same time explaining what's in the documents. Scores of them, I guess hundreds now. EFF, NSA. And you know what? That's a real project that I've been meaning to get to finally just, I don't know, tie myself to this chair and spend all day Saturday. I bet I could read it all in 12 hours or something. And start at the beginning and go through it again and better. It's a lot of stuff, man. And if you really want to know what it says, you got to read Marcy Wheeler. But that's, you know, for graduate level studies of this shit. Anyway, stuff. The stuff. All right. Now, so I can't tell you how pissed off I am about this. The story came out yesterday, as far as I know. I told you about it. The people in Farmersville, Texas, who are trying to block the creation of an Islamic cemetery. Based on the most ignorant... I can't believe this. How can we stop a mosque or a madrasa training center from going in there? If we let them bury their dead there, they being, you know, these American... Texan neighbors of theirs who believe in a different religion. They! If they can bury their dead here, why, they might build a mosque where they would go in there and worship the same God that I do. Ah! We can't have them building mosques wherever they want. And then I love it. Or a madrasa. Look, pal, unless the CIA and the Saudis are building an Al-Qaeda training camp in your county, I don't think that's going to be your problem. For God's sake. But now, the argument is that, oh no, well that's okay. They're just going to put pig heads on spikes and pour pig's blood all over the ground. And then that way it can never be holy. And so you'll just have to go somewhere else with your dark skin and your funny language and your crazy beliefs in the same God that they worship too. Can you believe that that's real? In 2015? In Texas? Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Yeah, American right-wingers, man. Conservatives or radicals or moderates even. I don't know. Barbarians, man. It sounds like... Doesn't it sound like a sad old story from back before you were born? Yeah, and then the local Klan gathered round to put pigs' heads on spikes and pour blood all around to keep Muslims from making a mosque. Oh, no, not even. From having a cemetery to bury their dead. Because of the risk that that could lead to a mosque. It's a slippery slope. Next thing you know, you got Al-Qaeda training in a madrasa. Madrasa. Oh, I know, that just means school, but doesn't it sound scary? Madrasa. Man. Anyway. I don't know. That's a damn shame. I really wonder, is anybody who's not a Muslim sticking up for these people or what up there? What's the local, county commissioner's court got to say about this? What's the local sheriff got to say about this? What's the mayor, if they have a mayor there? I think it might just be kind of a little unincorporated little thing. Anyway, well, that's where we're at. You know, hey, the war party had to pretend that they hate us because their terrible religion makes them hate us, and so this is just collateral damage, that's all. A bunch of American idiots believe that crap, and this is how they acted out. I don't know. All right, well, here I got more police state news, but here real quick I wanted to mention this hilarity. I just got in a fight the other day. Oh, it's from my last Tom Woods interview, the one before the one on Iran and Rand. The one before that was about the Islamic State, and I remember seeing in the comments there, nuh-uh, Israel does not support the al-Nusra Front. I don't know what you're talking about. That's crazy talk. Oh, yeah, that's funny, because in Haaretz today, they're announcing Israel halts medical treatment for members of Syria's Nusra Front. Well, how are they going to halt what they ain't begun, huh? The change took place a month after Israeli Druze ambushed and wounded Syrian rebels being transported in IDF ambulances, killing one of the men. Five members of the Druze community were later arrested on suspicion of murder. Yeah, that's because Al-Qaeda in Syria is killing the Druze in Syria. So the Druze in northern Israel were defending their countrymen from their government's treacherous treason. That's right, Israel's on the side of Al-Qaeda. I mean, so is America, but still, so is Israel. And that ain't good. They announced now that they're going to halt it. And now, there's this story. It's kind of ridiculous, man. I don't know exactly what's going on here with this. This is Micah Zenko from... He's the good guy. He is a good guy at the Council on Foreign Relations. I've never seen him advocate anybody getting bombed ever. Or even support for anybody bombing anybody, either side in anything. I read an article about him that said he's a pacifist. He ain't come across a reason for violence yet. And I don't know whether that means, you know, personally, if somebody tries to kill him, that he would rather die than resist with violence or what. There are people who are principled like that, for real. But I never read anything. I guess I read things where I disagreed with his opinion about something, but it was never, or his take on, you know, what was the truth of something. But I don't remember him ever advocating any government policy, really at all, which are all violent, in my, you know, by my categorization. This is a critique of the Pentagon program, where they trained up 60 rebels, and they put them in there, and they said, you're only allowed to fight ISIS. And as John McCain complains, if Assad attacks them, we're not going to help them. Micah Zenko here at realcleardefense.com compares the situation to Cuba, 1961. What are we doing? We're sending in guys to stab them in the back and betray them at the Bay of Pigs. Which is really the same thing we've been doing all along. Which is, in fact, what I used to call it. I kind of forgot, but I used to call it that years ago. That's all this really is. If they're not really going to support the overthrow of Assad, then what are they doing? It's just another big Bay of Pigs in the desert out there. Oh, rise up against your Baathist dictatorship. We'll support you, and then we leave them high and dry, or at least, you know, not armed enough to win. Same thing as Bush Sr. did in 1991 against Saddam. Encouraged the Shia and the Kurds to rise up. So, either way, it's all horrible. It's all treachery if loyalty is supposed to be to mankind. And Assad is a fascist dictator. I don't know of anybody who ever said that the guy's not a fascist dictator. It's just that he's a fascist dictatorship with majority support of the people of his country against the jihadist head chopper suicide bombers that work for the United States of America and its allies in the region. I sure as hell don't support their fascist dictatorship. I'm just telling you who's on the other side of the war and explaining why the dictatorship still has majority support there. And imagine, this is what I want to hear someone ask Obama, especially as he's all strutting around from all his recent political victories and all this and that. Hey, Obama, you agree, don't you, like everybody else, that not only was the Iraq war bad, but debothifying the government and dissolving the Iraqi army, that was a real thing. You've said that before, right? That really helped lead to the insurgency and the terrible problems there, right? Why is that your policy in Syria right now? To overthrow the entire government, to debothify it, to abolish the army. I mean, you think the Syrian civil war has been bad so far? Just wait. This guy Obama, man, he's the master PR. You gotta hand it to him. Robert Perry over there at Consortium News. I told y'all about this one last week, right? Robert Perry, he wants to love Obama so bad. And then he looks at the facts and he goes, Obama's worse than Bush. Look what he's done, man. He's got us into a real-ass cold war with Russia. I mean, Bush kind of flirted with a little bit of that crap. And he expanded NATO, really. He pushed it. But Obama went after Ukraine. And man, what a legacy. Big smile. All new nightmares. And same thing for the terror war, too, man. I love blaming George W. Bush as bad as anyone else. I'll tell you, George W. Bush is 100% responsible, but so is Obama. You know, walking around pretending he won the war on terror, killed every last terrorist when they got Osama. And then right around then, he started backing them in Libya, well, before then even, backing Osama's men in Libya and then in Syria. And you can go back and listen to the archives of this show all through 2011, 12, 13, 14. About the rise of Al-Qaeda in Syria. Al-Qaeda in Iraq in Syria. And the rise of the Islamic State. And Eric Margolis and Patrick Coburn and Darja Mail and whoever I can't think of. Probably even Bob Dreyfus. Nah, I quit interviewing him back before that. Anyway. The Leverets, back when they would still give me the time of day, would talk about this all the time. So anybody woulda, coulda, shoulda knew. This is going to be the consequence. I think they had to have known. That DIA report. Now, it's interesting about that DIA report. A friend of mine said, hey, let me tell you, I work for the government, and I'm here to tell you about reports like that. Yeah, they go everywhere, but they don't mean anything. Everybody just looks at it and files it away, and nobody ever does anything. And your ass is covered, basically, but nobody learns stuff. It's just, it's socialist bureaucracy. It's, you know, the Pentagon is communism in practice. It doesn't work. It's a complete, bumbling, ridiculous mess. And there is no pricing structure in order to set priorities or value on information. Or, God forbid, wisdom, if you could find any within those walls. Just doesn't work. And that rings true to me. That, yeah, of course, you know. Any idiot listening to this show knew what that report said in August of 2011. Question is whether Obama ever read it. And now, like I told you, on the 31st, Brad Hoff reported there was a Al Jazeera teaser where they talk, they interview this guy, Flynn, the former head of the DIA, and they ask him about that memo. So he has an institutional reason for sticking up for the memo writer and accusing those who ignore it, and apparently does so. So we'll see how that goes. Ah, crap, gotta go. Anyway, thanks everybody for listening. See you tomorrow.